Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone, Takuya here.
And I'm Gabby.
And welcome back to the podcast, my hoes. I'm going to go ahead and say this right now from the beginning, guys. I screwed up. I did. I really did. I made a promise this last time that this was going to be a two-part episode. I was wrong, okay? The sheer insane story of Ibn Battuta over the course of creating this thing made me think, oh, yeah, no, I could totally split this into two parts. It'll be fine. And then I got like 8 pages into this and I was like, okay, I'm not halfway to the point here that I thought that I was going to end this thing. So, as it turns out, there's going to be a third part to this. And for that, I apologize.
You always underestimate how long it would take.
I do. Yeah, I actually do. It's one of my big faults. It definitely is one of my big faults. And I have a number of them, but that is definitely one of the big ones, is underestimating things. I would be a terrible military commander from that. Like, you know how there's that big whole thing of like underestimating an enemy? That would be my precise thing. It's like, oh no, I'm sure it'll be fine. They can't totally have 10,000 people here. At max, it's 5. And then lo and behold, I'm surrounded. That would be me.
Yeah, I would be you.
Anyway, from our story from where we left off, Ibn Battuta had left Morocco. He'd gone on his little adventure, and by little, I mean massive adventure across the Middle East, had gone down into Arabia, had gone down into Africa, had gone up into Persia and other territories. And here, well, now here was going to be a continuation of his journey. Also, since we're talking about journeys here again, I figured that this would be a great time to tell you all that there are still a couple early bird spots that are left for our trip that we're going to be taking to Germany. If you don't want to see the Christmas markets with us and you don't want that $200 discount, then you can check out the trip that we're doing to Peru, which is going to be in July, or Italy, which is in May. And the links for all that are down in the description. So, okay, where we last left off with Ibn Battuta, he had spent about a year in Mecca where he was studying and making his third pilgrimage.
Post-dysentery, of course.
Well, yes, of course, because it's what it is that he had to do. He was thinking, though, more and more about doing something else. He didn't want to stay in one place for very long. And specifically, he had been hearing tales about the Sultan of Delhi, which was, when I say Delhi, for anyone who is confused about that, I mean, yes, as in the city of Delhi in India. That was the Muslim-controlled region in India, which actually at the time had a pretty massive empire. The Sultan there was reportedly welcoming scholars and judges from abroad, and if you went there, he would just give you a high-paying job. Like, if you just showed up and you were an educated Muslim, you were going to pretty much get rich there. That was almost a guarantee, it seems. At least those were the rumors. But first, in order to get there, Ibn Battuta had to get a guide. Someone who was going to be able to speak Persian, someone who knew how to get to India and knew India pretty well. So in the year 1330, he went to the town of Jid on the Red Sea. And after looking unsuccessfully for a guide to India for several months, he decided, okay, well, since I can't really go to India, I'm going to continue to travel elsewhere. Like, he just, you know, just completely changed his mind. And instead, he went north to Turkey. This would be the region, though at the time it wasn't called Turkey, it was just, you know, the region of Anatolia. From there, he would be able to connect with any Turkish caravans that possibly were traveling along the Silk Road to go to India. And what he would then do is travel back into Egypt, where he would meet a friend. They would then go by caravan to Damascus, Syria, and from there, they would head north for Anatolia. Ibn Battuta's small group would leave Syria on a large galley ship that was belonging to a Genoese trading mission. And from there, they would arrive at Alanya in Anatolia. This was a town that was a pretty busy trading port, and it was especially famous for its wood, which was something that was heavily shipped down to Egypt and Syria, which historically, I'm not sure if many people are familiar with large swaths of the Middle East, but there's not all that much wood. They don't really have as many trees there, which meant that it was a very valuable commodity that you can send down. As he would describe the journey, quote, "We set out for the country of the Turks. It was conquered by the Muslims, but there are still a large number of Christians there that are under the protection of the Turkmen Muslims. We traveled on the sea for 10 nights, and the Christians treated us honorably and took no passage money from us. On the 10th day, we arrived at Alanya, where the province begins. This country is one of the finest in the world. In it, God has brought together the good things dispersed through other lands. Its people are the most comely of men, the cleanest in their dress, and the most delicious in their food, and the kindliest folk in creation. Wherever we stopped in this land, whether at hospice or at private house, our neighbors, both men and women, these do not veil themselves, came to ask after our needs. When we left them, they bade us farewell as though they were our relatives and our own folk, and you would see." The thing about this is that when he's going and traveling this place, is he absolutely loves Anatolia. He loves how hospitable they are. But there's something else. While he did praise the Turks' hospitality and how committed they were to being proper Sunni Muslims, he was very surprised by certain things, such as the fact that they ate hashish, which is essentially Indian hemp. It's a type of drug that is like marijuana. And he was shocked that they did this and just didn't care. Like, they didn't think anything of it. That was something that, for anyone who is unfamiliar with the Muslim faith, it's like, you know how that we talk about Mormons out in, why can I not remember the name of the university?
Yes, BYU?
Yes, BYU. How there was that whole controversy about caffeine on campus.
That's always a controversy. It's always ongoing.
Yeah. So that is what we're talking about here, except in this case, it was, you know, Indian hemp, and it was like a drug that was almost like marijuana. And he was shocked that they would be able, that or not be able to, but that they would inebriate themselves using the substance when you specifically were not supposed to within Islam. And in every town that he would visit, he was welcomed by a fraternity of Muslim brothers. Every time he went to a place, they would provide him with food, with shelter, and apparently they would even compete with each other, like with other fraternities, for the honor of entertaining their guests. And whoever could entertain them the most, whoever could give them the biggest welcome, that is how they earned like a great and honorable place in society. As he would say about the whole event, quote, "We stayed here at the college mosque of the town. Now, in all lands inhabited by the Turkmens in Anatolia, in every district, town, and village, there are to be found members of the organization known as the Young Brotherhood. Nowhere in the world will you find men so eager to welcome strangers, so prompt to serve food and to satisfy the wants of others. The members of this community work during the day to gain their livelihood and bring what they have earned in the late afternoon. With this, they buy fruit, food, and the other things which the hospice requires for their use. If a traveler comes to town that day, they lodge him, and he stays with them until he goes away. If there are no travelers, then they themselves assemble to partake of the food, and having eaten it, sing and dance. On the morrow, they return to their occupations and bring their earnings to their leader in the late afternoon." So in other words, from all this, again, there was major competition between these varying different groups as to, well, how well they could entertain. And he was going to take advantage of this as much as possible. Ibn Battuta would stay in the homes of important leaders, some of them even related to the Ilkhan of Persia himself. And at every single place, as was custom, he was given hospitality gifts. Sometimes people just gave him money. Sometimes they gave him robes. Sometimes they gave him a horse or even a slave. Like, just anything and everything that you can think of that would have been a good gift back in the day, he was going to get. And oftentimes a letter of introduction that he would then be able to use to the next person or place where he was going to be going to along the trip to, you know, have a nice place to stay. As he traveled through Turkey, he would see many different things. But what seems to have shocked him when he did this was that specifically there was a varying different, how do I even phrase this? The status of women, whether they were free or slave, was very different from what he had expected and saw. As he would say, and I quote, "A remarkable thing which I saw in the country was the respect shown to women by the Turks, for they hold a more dignified position than the men. I saw also the wives of the merchants and the common men. Their faces are visible, for the Turkish women do not veil themselves. Sometimes a woman will be accompanied by her husband, and anyone seeing him would take him for one of her servants. This was something that absolutely shocked him, because obviously he's coming from a region that was very pious, strict when it came to their interpretation of Sunni Islam. And you're going to hear over the course of this a lot of comments that he's going to make about women at the time. And it actually provides us with a very valuable, well, it provides us with valuable insight as to how this wasn't a singular uniform custom and practice everywhere where people had to closely and strictly veil themselves. It was actually different in different parts of the world. But the whole reason that I even bring this up in the first place, because in one town that he would visit, he was extremely critical of how it is that they treated slave women. As he would say, the inhabitants of the city would make no effort to stamp out immorality. Indeed, the same applies to the whole population of these regions. What they would do is buy beautiful Greek slave girls and then put them out to prostitution. And each girl has to pay a regular due to her master. I heard it said that the girls go to the bathhouses along with the men, and anyone who wishes to indulge in depravity does so in the bathhouse and nobody tries to stop him. I was told that the governor in the city owns slave girls employed in this way. And it's this point that I really just need to say something that I want you to keep in mind. Remember how I said in the first part of the story, for anyone who listened to the first episode, which I really hope that you did before going into this, the whole deal with Battuta is that he kept no notes. He told his story orally 3 decades later to another guy who embellished it. So what I can say here is that he definitely does offer us some really great insights on these places that he describes, things that in general, many people would never have even thought of writing down in the first place. But the amount of times that he relates a story as, oh, I was told this happens, it's a bit frustrating, and it makes me think of the Netflix docudramas and the amount of, oh, I thinks in there. But either way, that being said, there is nothing that we can really do about it. He is still easily one of the most valuable sources for insights into this time and from many different places around the world at this point that otherwise we would know pretty much nothing about. But anyway, in November of 1331, Ibn Battuta and 3 friends, which would also include 2 of their slave boys and a slave girl, along with several horses and gifts from governors and hosts, they would start out towards the Black Sea. Now, Ibn Battuta had benefited greatly from the generosity of the Turks. This was obvious. He was traveling in style at this point. But the next part of the trip was not exactly going to be easy, because he would end up getting caught in a raging river. He would be misled by a guide who got the party lost and then demanded money from them. He would almost freeze to death, but they would end up making it through. And they would arrive at the port of Sinop on the Black Sea, and they were ready to leave towards the steppe lands, the home of the Golden Horde. And I'm going to need to explain that because there's probably a bunch of people who've never really heard of this thing before. When Genghis Khan died, he divided the Mongol Empire into 4 different khanates, these being, you know, where they would have the individual khans who would rule this territory, and these were for his sons and grandsons. The Golden Horde was the northwestern khanate. This included much of Eastern Europe and Russia and was a very large territory. The interesting thing to note about this is that unlike when the Mongols went and conquered Persia, and they then settled down in the cities and they adopted Persian culture and these types of things, or how the Yuan dynasty did the same kind of thing in China, where they settled in and became Chinese or, you know, adopted that culture, the Golden Horde didn't really do that. They maintained their nomadic customs on the Russian steppes, and as a result, would continue on as a Mongol horde for many, many years. And so after waiting more than a month for good weather, Ibn Battuta and his small party would board a ship and they began to cross the Black Sea. Severe storms, though, would hit, and when this happened, it would almost cause the entire ship to capsize. But after several days of panicking and almost disasters occurring, they would manage to arrive at the opposite coast. They then would reach Kaffa, which was a Genoese colony, which had around 200 ships in its harbor. And here, traders from all over Europe had gathered, from Genoa, from Egypt, Russia, Venice, elsewhere. This is where some of the biggest and best traders across the continent were gathered. The thing is, though, there was only one mosque. This being because, unlike a lot of the places that Ibn Battuta had visited up until this point, Kaffa was a Christian settlement, something that was still in Christian control. And so when the church bell rang that, you know, was signaling the time or calling people to church, Ibn Battuta and his friend actually ended up being offended by this because they were so used to being surrounded by so many Muslims that they just, it was like the shocking thing that this was a place where Christianity was dominant. So they went to the top of their lodging and angrily started to call on people like to arrive for prayer, like for Muslim prayer. And some other Muslims in the area then had to rush to them and try to stop them because that could potentially lead to a religious fight inside of the city and get them all expelled. And that is not something that they wanted to do.
Hey everyone, Sakuya here, and before we get back to the show, I would just like to thank today's sponsor, Rocket Money. For those of you who don't know, Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps to find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions, it helps monitor your spending, and it helps to lower your bills all in one place so that you can help grow your savings. This is something that I personally have been using for the past 2 years, even before it ever was Rocket Money, since it was a service called Truebill. Because I don't know if anyone actually knows this from me personally here, from reaching out on Discord or anything else like that, but I have a tendency to forget things a lot, like to straight up just forget everything, which is weird coming from the history guy who seems to go and learn about and talk about everything. But the everyday stuff like subscriptions, I am always forgetting about, and this is usually something that greatly angers my wife. Because of that, Rocket Money has been something that has absolutely saved my life. It has gone in and helped me catch all these different things that otherwise I would be charged for years for. So I'm telling you all this right now. You should definitely sign up for this yourself because it is a huge help. Stop wasting money on things that you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/ho. That is rocketmoney.com/HOE. rocketmoney.com/HOE. Hey everyone, Sakuya here. And before we get back to the show, I would just like to thank today's sponsor, eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure that your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The next day, he would move on to another city with a much larger Muslim population because they just simply didn't want to stay in that kind of place anymore. And this is something that, as we tell his story, you're going to hear quite a bit about. He is an extremely valuable resource for describing these things, but he definitely has a lot of his own biases that are made very painfully obvious. So, at the Black Sea ports, they could see the trade goods of the steppe. They could see the grains, the timber, the furs, the salt, the honey, the wax, all these valuable things, as well as the stuff that was coming along the Silk Road from Persia and China. And everywhere you looked, there were slaves. War captives, the sad children of poor parents who sold their children to survive.
Did people really do that?
Yes.
They sell their children to survive.
So in a time of famine, this was one of the most common. Think about this. You have a farm. What is the labor on a farm?
Children.
Typically children. This is one of the reasons why farming communities are very fertile usually, is that children were free labor.
What happened if a farmer didn't have kids?
They usually had to hire help, but that was expensive and it wasn't good for them. Like farming was a very family dependent thing. That's what you had to utilize. Or you use slaves. Like, where do you think plantations, like that's where the whole thing would come from and why they would do that.
Because they couldn't have enough kids.
Yeah, it was very, well, it was. Also, it was way more labor dependent and also more brutal work. And that wasn't something you wanted your children to be doing. It's not a clean thought, but that's the reality of it. And so let's say that you had a drought, something happened and half your crop died.
Yeah.
Well, now you're not going to have the food necessary to feed your entire family.
OK, that's wild because your entirety of kids not being sold into slavery would just be. Is there going to be a drought or not? That is a wild thought.
Yes. And that literally would happen. That is what would happen. And so these children would go to the slave markets in Cairo, you know, potentially from there, some of them could have been turned into eunuchs and shipped off to an Ottoman court. You could have had something where they would be sent to the sugar plantations that existed on Cyprus or be sent as servants to rich households inside of Italy because there were whole thriving Muslim communities that were there. Or just sent off to some other households. You never really knew. So when they would arrive then at Al-Kiram, which was another city, and this one, you can already judge from the name, was definitely not a Christian settlement, Ibn Battuta's party of travelers finally heard some good news. They had managed to arrive just in time to make the 700-mile-long trip to the Volga River under the protection of the King of the Golden Horde, who had actually just traveled a few days ahead of them, so they were very, very close to being able to catch up and actually be part of a large caravan. So they bought three wagons, they got the animals to pull them, and they rushed as fast as they could to go and catch up. And soon, they would catch up to the caravan of the Kipchak Khan, Ulzbek, who was the King of the Golden Horde. The Khan's caravan was described at this time like being a massive, vast city, something that would move with its inhabitants, with mosques, bazaars, the smoke of kitchens rising in the air as they cook on the march. It was literally a mobile city. Because remember what I said in the beginning, the Golden Horde did not adopt a settled lifestyle like the Mongol conquerors of Persia or other regions. They kept their nomadic traditions. And as he settled in, Ibn Battuta was shocked at how well the animals were treated. And by well they were treated, I mean the fact that they weren't just stolen, because, well, there's a very key reason. As he would say, every time the Turks would halt, they would just loose their horses, their oxen, their camels, and they would drive them out to pasture just free, night or day. They didn't have shepherds, they didn't have guardians, they just let all the animals loose. That is shocking, because in any other society around Earth, what would be happening there at the time is you let your animals out, and since animals are a huge sign of wealth and are very valuable, someone is likely to come along and steal them. But this didn't happen here. And the reason he said so is because this was because of the severity of the laws against theft. Because if there was any person who was found in possession of a stolen horse, that person would be obliged to restore it with 9 others. So you had to return back. If you were found with stolen property, you had to return 9 times its value. If you could not do this, that person's sons were taken as slaves. If he had no sons, they were slaughtered. Really, the whole thing is a stronger variant of an eye for an eye.
Wow.
So the next morning after Ibn Battuta had arrived at the massive tent camp caravan thing, he goes and meets the king, the Khan, Ulzbek, who is seated upon a silver throne in the middle of a huge tent whose exterior is covered with a layer of bright gold tiles.
So the tent had tiles.
Oh, hugely wealthy. You know how we just bought that tent? I want you to imagine something 100 times that.
So, okay. So what was it, like a canvas tent? How do they put the gold? Were there real gold tiles? How did they
felt
get them?
Felt yurts.
Okay. So and then you put gold tiles on that?
Yes. You could apply it over the top as a kind of thing where it would be a to help shed like rain and things.
So can we get gold tiles for our LARP tent?
I'm
so glad you agree. Okay, continue.
They would also be sewn into it. I think it was specifically to make it shine bright. Would technically speaking, if we did that in the middle of the summer and we had a multicolored, you could turn the entire thing into looking like stained glass where it just shimmers.
Okay, that sounds cool.
It does.
But it was warm here, right?
Well, in the summer, yes.
So that could be really pretty.
Yes, but in winter, oh my God, these things, this place gets ridiculously cold.
Well, yeah.
So when he arrives and he sees all this, right, it's really impressive. But what was confusing was that the family of the Khan were below the throne, but the 4 wives that he had were seated next to him. See, interesting fact here. In the Mongol states, women would actually, like women of the court, like the ones who were royal women, they actually shared in the governing of the realm. Princesses, just like brothers, they could be awarded their own land, which they would rule and tax. Like, women actually had more capability in that place and time than in many other areas, which was really unique. This, the lack of veils, and the fact that they drank millet beer, oh, this shocked Battuta. Because remember, he was a strict Muslim. And so the idea of people inebriating themselves with beer and their women having power like that and not wearing veils, how that couldn't happen. But it's besides the point. The biggest thing, the biggest offense that absolutely shocked him was that at one point, the great Khan even came drunk to a dinner. Remember, Muslim, not supposed to be drinking, which severely embarrassed him.
Oh.
Yeah. So when they reached Astrakhan, Ibn Battuta would learn that the third wife of the Khan was pregnant, and the Khan had given her permission to go back to her father, who was the king or emperor of the Byzantine Empire. From there, the whole point was because she wanted to have her baby back in Constantinople.
Why?
Because it was a whole thing where she had specific... Okay, so this is going to be a little bit of a complex thing. The Byzantine Empire by this point is not in a good state. It is really not. It is the early 1300s, and it has been completely broken. It has been trying to bribe as many people as it can to leave them alone. It no longer has a professional army, and it entirely utilizes forces of mercenaries to protect their borders. It shrank from what it once was. It can't do anything. And so the third wife of the Khan, this princess, she had been specifically married off to the Khan in order to be a political tool for peace, right? To not be invaded. And one of the conditions was that she would be able to go back and visit. Like, that was one of the stipulations that they would have. So in this case, she was able to take her baby back with her and have it there because it's what she wanted to do. And he was going to allow this. This is something that Ibn Battuta was going to jump on, because he was going to ask the Khan if he could also go and get permission to go there, because this would be another chance for him to see another part of the world. His first time to go beyond the world of Islam, the Dar al-Islam, and from there see one of the greatest ancient cities of the world.
Would he be okay to go beyond the world of Islam was the question he should ask himself.
And there were many different times over the course of the story that you're going to wonder precisely that, because in many cases it does not end well.
Oh, did he write a lot of, like, judgy stuff?
Oh, he was very, every single place that he went, he was super judgy.
I get that, though, because if I were to write a book of my travels, ooh,
yeah,
the judgment.
Yeah, he is, again, a very valuable resource in order to describe many of these places at this time, but also, simultaneously, you have to understand that he inherently had his own biases. He was literally a member of, like, he was a Qadi, right? He was one of the religious elites in the Muslim world. That's like saying, you know, a Greek, not even Greek, but like a Catholic bishop went traveling to Saudi Arabia and just started judging people for everything. It's like he's a literal bishop, okay? You're going to expect that. So then in July of 1332, they set out with around 5,000 horsemen, 500 of her personal soldiers and servants, 200 slave girls, 20 Indian and Greek pages, which are like little servant boys, 400 wagons, 2,000 horses, and about 500 oxen and camels. What is really crazy about this whole thing is, right, they're traveling with this massive entourage. And unfortunately, as they are traveling, you know how there's that whole thing about hospitality that is supposed to be provided for guests?
What about it?
Well, the whole thing here is that the people along the way were required to support this massive caravan with food. And this would be considered part of the tax that was required to support the local rulers.
Interesting.
So yeah, they got sucked dry, basically. And this wasn't a quick journey either. After traveling for around 75 days, they finally arrived in Constantinople. And Ibn Battuta noticed something that really bothered him. As they got closer and closer to the city, this former Christian princess who had converted to Islam, she stopped the calls to prayer. She no longer partook in Muslim practices. They brought out wines, and these were brought to her, and she even ate pork.
Isn't she pregnant? She's just drinking wine.
Yeah, but that's also what was judged at the time. Like, remember, her marriage to the Khan was something that was a completely political arrangement. She converted to Islam, but she didn't really convert to Islam. This is like one of those things that oftentimes happened with many different conversions in history. Is that, yes, there were initial conversions for whether to Christian, to Islam, or to any other faith. It usually took several generations for those practices to actually stick, like, to the person, you know, to
because
actually follow it.
Before, she didn't do any of these practices. And now, I mean, it was an arranged marriage. She didn't want to convert. So, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Yes, it's shocking, but it checks out.
Exactly. So Ibn Battuta would arrive in Constantinople, and he would stay there for a month. He even at the time got to meet the emperor, who was Andronicus III, and he saw many of the different sites of the capital city of the Christians, the New Rome, which, for anyone confused about this, Constantinople had become the capital of the Roman Empire in the mid-4th century, and the inhabitants of the region still referred to themselves as the Romans. They didn't call themselves Greek. They didn't call themselves Byzantine. That was a later invention in, like, the 17th century, I think it was, or 18th century. I can't remember when it was. they specifically referred to themselves as the Romans.
Really?
Yeah. He even went and saw the great Christian cathedral of the Hagia Sophia, though he did not actually ever go inside. Actually, on that note, I still think I remember seeing something here. I remember seeing a story about people like in Turkey that straight up did not believe that the Hagia Sophia had ever been a church, that it had always been a mosque. And that shocked me that some people would never have seen that there before. That's like people in Spain not knowing that large swaths of the south had been, you know, Muslim controlled before.
I think maybe they just don't go over that time period. You know what I'm saying?
I don't know.
Why would it be taught?
Because it's an important part of the history, I guess. But,
well, yeah, it's an important part of the history, but maybe they weren't proud of it. So it's just not really brought up.
I don't know. That's a very important question then. So this princess that Ibn Battuta had escorted with, she decided to stay for some time with her father in Constantinople and, you know, just basically resume being a Christian princess. That's what she would do. But she gave permission to her escorts to return home to the Kipchak Khan. So Ibn Battuta would once again set off for the steppe, the grassy lands of the nomadic Golden Horde. However, when he went back to the steppe, it was no longer as nice as when he went the first time.
Oh, was it cold now?
Yeah, the thing about the steppe is that it doesn't exactly retain heat very well. And this is just at the moment that the very heavy Eurasian winter had set in. So this guy is going to this land that, mind you, remember, he is from Morocco at a time before AC or anything else like that. He is used to traveling in desert climates, very hot. He was so cold that he regularly had to wear 3 fur coats all at the same time, 2 pairs of trousers, 2 pairs of heavy socks, and heavy boots that were lined with bear skin. And
okay.
If you think he's exaggerating or being a little crazy, because it does sound a little extra, doesn't it?
I mean, no, that's how I dress in winter.
Okay, yeah, I get that. But for a lot of people, they're going to think that he's a bit crazy until they know that whenever he washed with hot water, like water that had literally been heated over a fire, and then he tried to wash his face or other things, the water would run down his beard, and before it reached the end of his beard, it would freeze.
How did people stay warm?
So the yurts, like the actual things they had there, were very well constructed. Remember, these things were made out of felt, so it was like giant animal skins. Very warm, especially with how they would be multi-layered. They would be sealed with, why can't I remember the term? So they used oil, they used fats, they used all different kinds of things that would provide a kind of seal on it that would stop heat from being able to escape. So they were very good at that. They would have fires inside of these yurts.
I'm assuming the baby boom after winter was wild.
Oh, yeah. And also, especially remember that it was men having multiple wives. So
also,
yeah.
The thing is, that would actually keep you pretty warm if they all fit a tent. I'm just thinking logistics, okay? Actually, I read this really interesting story. I don't know if it was New York Times, but it was one news source that posted that people were actually saving money, on heat in winter in America by just having sex.
Yeah. There was also that thing that was said, what was it, about saving money by just not eating?
Well, yeah, a lot of people eat once a day. So, I mean, we're doing great, guys.
This is going to sound so weird to say, but it would be very funny, sad in this scenario for why, but sad but funny if it simultaneously solved the obesity crisis and also the population issue just by virtue of people sleeping around more and also eating less.
But inflation is going to take us out. I don't think people can afford to have kids.
Oh, yeah, no, they cannot. They absolutely cannot. Like that, it is absolute insanity, which is why one of the videos I'm going to be doing here in the future is specifically on talking about the housing crisis and how that has developed, because it's not pretty, my friends.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Throughout history, royals across the world were notorious for incest. They married their own relatives in order to consolidate power and keep their blood blue. But they were oblivious to the havoc all this inbreeding was having on the health of their offspring. From Egyptian pharaohs marrying their own sisters to the Habsburgs' notoriously oversized lower jaws, I explore the most shocking incestuous relationships and tragically inbred individuals in royal history. And that's just episode one. On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ+ royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. I'm Lindsay Holiday, and I'm spilling the tea on history. Join me every Tuesday for new episodes of the History Tea Time podcast, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.
Either way, we need to talk about a time that definitely didn't have nearly as many troubles as what we have now. The late medieval period. That was a joke. It was obviously a very different time, and they had plenty of their own troubles that were way worse than what it is that we have today. So, they would once again reach Astrakhan, but after this would continue northward to meet the Khan, who was then at Nusray, which was a city up the Volga River, which was now frozen. Here, too, there was a band of Muslim scholars and hopeful bureaucrats that were hoping to find jobs in the frontier cities of the world of Islam, because from there, you know, they needed to go to places that had less, God, what is the right term here? Not presence, that's frequency? No, that's not the right term. Gabby,
what are you trying to say?
I'm trying to think of the term for what happens to where there's not a lot of something in an area because it's new, like it's because it's scarce there. And there was a specific term.
It wasn't established?
Yes, that's the term. Okay, because frontier cities were not established. Thank you. I don't know why I was failing to remember that. But
Before I was asleep would probably have something to do with your lack of memory. Before I was asleep, the fever, the working nonstop for 3 days.
Yeah, I'm...
While sick. I mean,
yeah,
just to name a few.
Yeah, I haven't been doing well, guys, here. But the work doesn't stop. And we still have had stuff to create and stories to tell. So yes, these people were hoping to go to places that weren't established because there was way less scholars there, meaning they would be able to achieve a much greater degree of power, influence, and wealth in those spots. Yes, because there was a scarcity, a lack of them available. Thank you. So Ibn Battuta would leave the Volga River colony and he would head south, generally towards India. For 5 months, he would travel through the different regions that had been conquered by the Mongols. And in the aftermath of the conquest, large parts of the civilization that had existed there for hundreds, thousands of years was gone, like wiped out. In Bukhara, as an example, he would report, quote, "The mosques, colleges, and bazaars are in ruins. There is not one person in it today who possesses any learning or shows any concern for acquiring it." Because, again, those places were freaking destroyed. Like, the big walled cities that had tried to resist the Mongols earlier had been completely wiped out. This is kind of funny, though, because not in the whole wiping out part, but the destruction that he saw was actually the lighter variant, because that was only their first pass through. Later on, I can't even remember how far away it is from when he's doing his travels, but within the next century, the Mongols were going to come back again in the form of Tamerlane, like Timur the Great, and he was the guy who'd create literal pyramids of skulls. So, yeah. Anyway. Ibn Battuta would continue on his journey, leaving the steppe, the land of the Golden Horde, and from there he would cross into the land of the Khan of Chagatai, which was another descendant of Genghis Khan. This was the center of the Mongol Empire. Not culturally, geographically, like this was the place that was the middle of it all. But it was here where mostly nomadic herders lived with a few major trading cities or centers of learning. Generally speaking, they kept to the kind of lifestyle that you would have expected of the Mongol hordes. The present Khan, a guy by the name of Tamerlane, He was the first of his dynasty to make Islam the official religion of state. And Ibn Battuta would stay with the Khan for 54 days during the cold winter of 1333. When he left, he was given 700 dinars, 2 camels, and a nice warm sable coat. Very nice and rich gifts. A few months later in India, he would learn that the Khan had been overthrown by a nephew and a group of anti-Muslim commanders. So again, this would be another example, and we're going to see this many more times, where Ibn Battuta would arrive in a brief moment of peace before disaster would tear a kingdom apart. He somehow managed to magically escape this multiple times. So it's the spring then of 1333, and Ibn Battuta would continue with the others on his caravan into the mountain passes into Afghanistan. And here they would have to deal with bandits. They would have to deal with treacherous environments, rock slides, snow, everything. It was a rough journey. And after a 4-month journey through this land and the land of Chagatai, they finally rode into India. Here ruled by a Muslim conqueror, and it was here that Ibn Battuta had hoped to finally settle down and get a high-paying job and live out his days. He had finally arrived at his final destination. Or had he?
Had he?
No, he had absolutely not. If that was the case, then I wouldn't be saying that there would be a part three to all this. See, Ibn Battuta would enter India through the high mountains of Afghanistan. And from here, he would follow the footsteps of the Turkish warriors who, in the previous century, had conquered the Hindu farming people of India and established the Sultanate of Delhi. This was a state that didn't necessarily last all that long, but it was very violent, very quick, and it gobbled up large swaths of India very quickly. The first wave of Muslim soldiers that came in weren't actually trying to settle down. They instead were there more for raiding and establishing bases of operation. They would loot towns, they would smash the images of the gods of the Hindu worshippers. But when they would come back later as full conquerors, instead of trying to convert the entire population, the kings who conquered everything decided, hey, you know what would be great? We have this whole thing in Islam called a jizya tax, where if you don't convert and you keep your local religion, you're allowed to do it, but you gotta pay an extra tax. And kings like their taxes. So, rather than slaughter the peasants, they would largely allow people to live and let live with their native faith, but they would then have to pay an extra tax. They would replace the local Hindu leaders with Turks from Afghanistan, and from there, they would conquer and unite a large area, something that almost reached to the southern tip of the continent, or the subcontinent, I should say. But the thing is, these were foreign invaders. They were Muslim sultans in an area that was overwhelmingly Hindu. They would face constant opposition from the Hindu majority in India, who time and time again would continuously rebel against their conquerors. And also, not only having to deal with that, they would also have to deal with periodic Mongol invasions that were still coming from the north, because it wasn't safe. Thing is, over time, slowly, India was becoming more and more firmly controlled by Islamic leaders. Hindus were even at this point converting to Islam because they were finding that, oh, hey, if I actually go and convert to Islam, that means I can get a good government job. They recognized that there were actually good economic advantages to becoming Muslim. You would pay lower taxes. You had more opportunities for advancement under the present leader. This was something that in cities, you generally saw more of this population convert. In the rural areas, though, the population almost remained exclusively Hindu. It did not change. They had to pay their taxes, but they would be allowed to worship as they wished. And many of them, hated the Muslim government which had been imposed upon them. This is where you would see some of the greatest concentrations of resistance. In order to strengthen his hold on India, the Sultan who ruled from Delhi needed more people. He needed more judges. He needed scholars. He needed administrators. He needed warriors. He needed writers. He needed poets. He needed entertainers. He needed literally everything that you could possibly have in order to be able to run a state and maintain it. To do this, since he couldn't really get it from the local population, because, you know, even the people who converted to Islam from the area were not necessarily fully trusted. Remember, the whole thing we talked about with that Byzantine princess? He couldn't really trust recent converts.
So did they have like a set amount of time they let someone be before they could trust them?
That's a great question. It's going to be dependent upon the time, place, culture, and there's going to be different rules.
Like for a little initiation time frame. What are a trial period?
Yeah. So for some, it was literally just the next generation. For others, like in the case of
probationary, that's what it is. Like when you get a job and they're like, oh, you have 90 days where you have absolutely no benefits, but you're going to do all of the work. And then we'll decide if you're going to keep you. Like, did they have one of those, a probationary period?
I guess you could say so. There were some that went and put this back way far. Like as a key example, remember how Spain conquered, or rather it was Castile and Aragon and Portugal, the whole Reconquista, they conquered Spain back from the Muslims who had invaded centuries earlier, the whole thing with Al-Andalus?
Yes.
Okay, so when this happened, right, the Muslims who had been conquered in the south of the peninsula had been either expelled or forcefully converted to Christianity. Like the Jews, the Muslims, these people were forcefully converted, or converted willingly just to try and maintain their own livelihood in the state. Anyway, the reason I bring that up in the first place is because when time would go on, eventually the Christian rulers in Spain would go back on this and actually end up expelling a bunch of the Muslims, or not even Muslims, former Muslims who had converted. And I don't mean that they who had converted, like from their individual generation. I mean people who had been Christian for at least two generations at this point, and yet they were completely kicked out of the country because they could not deem to be trusted by the state. They didn't trust recent converts.
Interesting.
So it's going to vary depending upon the time and place. The Sultan was faced with a similar kind of situation. You couldn't trust the local population. So instead, he would recruit foreigners and he would reward them with fabulous gifts and very high salaries. Oh my God. We're going to describe this here in a second for what Ibn Battuta reportedly got paid when he was there. And it's pretty insane. Persians, Turks, Muslims from across Darul Islam, all these people flocked to the new empire looking for great rewards. Persian was the language at this point of the ruling elite, which pretty much meant that the capital city was isolated. It spoke none of the local language around it. It only spoke Persian, which was the language of the foreign conquerors. And it was here, from Sultan Muhammad Tughluq, that Ibn Battuta would try to gain employment. Now, when I talk about this guy, here's the thing. I'm going to have to specify this. Muhammad Tughluq was a person who is going to go down in history as an interesting character, to say the least. He was an amazing scholar. He was very bright. He was very kind and generous to people. He was also very erratic. He was very eccentric. He was an extremely violent and vindictive and paranoid ruler. He was a lot of things. He learned how to write Persian poetry and mastered the art of calligraphy. He could debate legal and religious issues with scholars, as he was very well learned. He had learned Arabic in order to read religious texts like the Quran, and he would shower gifts on scholars and Muslims who he trusted.
He sounds well-rounded, like a well-rounded guy who's just a little bit angry. I think a lot of people are just a little bit angry.
Yeah, but he also made a lot of bad decisions. He had a tendency to go way too far, whether it was about which battles to pursue, where and how to establish his government, you know, listening to the people around him, how to handle the economy. Like, he gave away so many gifts and did so many things and wasted so much money that he almost bankrupted the entire state. And what ended up pissing off a lot of people, he was very cruel with how he would administer justice. Like, this was a guy who was known as a cruel man, even by the Middle Ages. Like, when we talk about that, people usually talk about medieval punishment and that sort of thing. He was famous for being cruel in his justice, even back in the day. He was responsible not only for having rebels and thieves punished with cruel deaths, but also Muslim scholars and holy men. Basically, anyone who questioned him about his policies, even if they happened to be just a friend of a person who did, this would bring them up on a list that was the equivalent of Stalin calling for quotas of people needing to be executed. Anyone who questioned him, any friends, any association, you were dead. He was paranoid and fearful of any kind of criticism. As one observer would write, quote, "Not a week passed without the spilling of much Muslim blood and running the streams of gore before the entrance of the palace."
What?
Yeah, if you're wondering what it is I'm talking about, this reportedly included cutting people in half, skinning them alive, chopping off their heads and displaying them on poles as a warning to others, and having prisoners tossed about by elephants who had swords attached to their tusks.
Okay, points for creativity, but when you said he was like a little bit of an angry ruler, I thought like, you know, maybe he imprisoned some people, as would a reasonable person do if they were paranoid. But the elephant tusk thing is next level demented.
Especially since elephants, generally speaking, don't want to do that. Like, you have to actually torture an elephant to turn it into a war tool.
Any elephants that want swords on their tusks, first of all, wouldn't the tusks be enough?
Yeah, you'd think so. You would think so.
What do you get when you take two childhood friends with a passion for unexplored history and a whole lot of booze?
You get the goofiest game in history, Queen's Podcast.
Hi, I'm Nathan.
And I'm Katie, and we're the hosts of Queen's Podcast.
Join us while we spill the tea on women from history.
We get into all kinds of stories here, like biographies of lesser-known figures, for instance, Sayida Halhura, powerful pirate queen.
To the stories you might already know, like Marie Antoinette or Cleopatra, but with a fun twist.
Each queen is paired with a cocktail that'll totally get you in the mood to hear fun, juicy, and dramatic stories from history.
Because history is so much more than just dudes on a battlefield, and we believe that the female perspective and roles are just as deserving of their time in the spotlight.
Right. So come get to know these queens. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Cheers.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
So, as Ibn Battuta would write, quote, "The Sultan was far too free in shedding blood. He used to punish small faults and great without respect of persons, whether men of learning or piety or noble descent. Every day there are brought to the audience hall hundreds of people chained, pinioned, and fettered, and they are executed, tortured, or beaten."
What is he afraid of?
Yeah, I know, right? So
like, what exact? I understand dangers of being a ruler back in the day.
Remember, but literally everyone around him is a potential enemy. They are a minority ruling class.
Oh,
ruling,
I get that.
People that hate them.
I get that. But they gave them so many bribes, okay? To not kill them. Why is he killing everybody? To save money?
No.
On having to buy their loyalty?
He was an absolute ruler, and from all definitions of an absolute ruler. He was a guy who could not be questioned, because if you questioned him, potentially that meant that you could have been working with a general or some other kind of bureaucrat to oust him.
Don't get me wrong. I absolutely love his style, but I think maybe he's doing a little bit too much.
Yeah.
A tad.
So you could say that working for this man was very dangerous. It naturally was. But if you survive, which feels like a weird thing to say, but it's real. If you survive.
I feel like that's just employment, though. If you survive.
It's true. The rewards would be massive. So in late 1334, Ibn Battuta goes to Delhi to seek official employment. And there he signs a contract agreeing that he is going to stay in India. He goes and he cleverly assembles an arrange of gifts for the Sultan. He gets arrows, he gets some camels, horses, several slaves, other goods.
How are people just gifting slaves? This whole entire episode.
Slaves are everywhere.
I mean, it's just a gift.
Yeah.
A gift, a person.
This is a place that is constantly at war, right? The population, a lot of people are reproducing. That is, there's a lot of babies being born. Simultaneously, there's a lot of places that are being conquered and burned. There are places that are suffering famine. There are slaves everywhere, especially in the system. The biggest slave trading region in the world was across Central Asia and going down into Africa. It was huge at this point.
Huh.
And so Ibn Battuta goes and he gives these gifts. And the reason he does so, why he is giving a gift to the Sultan, is because everyone knows that if you gave gifts to Tughlaq, if you made him happy, then he was going to give you way more than you ever gave him. So when he arrives in Delhi, he has already given these gifts, and he in turn receives a welcoming gift of 2,000 silver dinars and gets put up in a very comfortable, furnished house. Muhammad Tughlaq at this time was not in Delhi, and so Ibn Battuta had to wait there. Tughlaq had received reports about his arrival and immediately hired Ibn Battuta without ever actually seeing him. Like, he literally heard about, oh, hey, this big traveling Muslim scholar has come here to our realm. Oh, okay, hire him. Literally never spoke to him, never had any idea about him, never had anything, just heard about him, hired him on the spot. And there he would receive an annual salary of 5,000 silver dinars to be paid from 2.5 villages located about 16 miles from the city. Now, I'm saying a lot of numbers here. There's a reason why I was saying how insane this number was. The average Hindu family reportedly lived on about 5 dinars a month. And he was receiving 5,000 a year. That he was receiving as much in a year what the average family was like literally 1,000 times what they made in a month. That's insane.
Wow.
So he was doing this for a while, and Muhammad Tughlaq would return in June. And there, Ibn Battuta and the other newcomers who had come with him from the caravan would go and greet the ruler with their gifts. And the next day, the Sultan comes parading into the city of Delhi. And on some of the elephants that he is leading in him, there are little catapults that are tossing out gold and silver coins to the crowd that is cheering him on. Right? This guy knows how to make an entrance. He knows how to be wild.
You think?
Oh, yeah.
The
he
elephant
does.
Tusk. That is the idea of a man who not only knows how to be wild, but he knows how to make an impression, a lasting impression. Like,
he
who
does.
Thinks of that, man?
Yeah, he does. And so from this, Ibn Battuta goes to work as a judge. Problem is, he doesn't really speak Persian very well. And so the Sultan goes and gives him two assistants. The basic idea of it was that these would be the actual guys who would be doing a lot of the daily reading. They would have to report to him, and he would make the final judgment call. That sort of thing.
Right. Right. Because he was a judge with his family from like the very beginning.
Yeah. He was a judge who didn't speak the language.
But if you were a judge, does that qualify you to be a judge everywhere else? I feel like.
Yeah.
There's no standardization of judges. You could just go judge another culture.
Everything was still based on Islamic law. That's the thing. And he was a Qadi of Sharia.
Oh, I know that. But still, it's a completely different types of tradition, right?
Correct. And this is something that he would actually have to intervene in a lot. Remember how I said how judgy he was for many different places that he went.
That was his job, though. So he had to be judgy. It was his nature.
He was literally a judge.
He was
of course,
judge
he was judgy.
By trade.
Yes. Okay. That fair statement. I can't really fault you for that. So he was a judge, right? But also he had a ton of time to be able to join the Sultan and the other high officials on elaborate hunting expeditions. And when you would participate in a royal hunt, which remember, you had to provide the stuff that you went on the hunt with yourself, this would require getting elephants, you had to get your own tents, you had to get a massive number of servants to carry all of your stuff. It was such an extravagant expense that even with the amount of money that Ibn Battuta was making, he was still going into debt. But luckily, the Sultan was very generous and would just give him more money to pay back his debts. He would also give Ibn Battuta another job, which would help make him some more money, and that would be to take care of the Qutb al-Din Mubarak Mausoleum. Now, of course, this massive complex was something that I think that when I was reading about this, it required like 460 servants to operate it. It was huge. And so to do this, Ibn Battuta would, of course, ask for more money to take care of the tomb. Not to mention money that he would use on himself to take care of his house, to do all the stuff, and the Sultan would just readily give it to him. While he is doing all of this, though, something happens that is going to change everything. Because over 1,300 miles away, one of Muhammad Tughlaq's governors rebels against him, and he instead proclaims himself as a Sultan. This then causes Tughlaq to have to bring his army south, and over the course of the next 2.5 years that the Sultan is away battling and waging war, Ibn Battuta is living here in Delhi. He acts as a judge, giving out punishments, including one of the cases. You remember how he hated when people were drinking? When a guy was caught doing this, he was punished with 80 lashes with a whip. Yeah.
What?
Yeah, that's, again, he was very strict about it. He did his job from how it would be that he would interpret things. 80 lashes for drinking wine, yes. In addition to all this, he was taking care of the tomb, which required a massive number of workers. He would collect debts from his village. But this became very hard because there was a disastrous famine that would end up hitting northern India in 1335, and it would last 7 years. As he would say, thousands upon thousands of people would perish of want. And naturally speaking, you can't really collect debts and taxes from people that are dead and have nothing. So he was forced to help to give them charity to the poor in order to try and preserve them. And he was just trying to maintain things at this time, and it was tough. The Sultan would eventually return, and his campaign was not successful. Because of this lack of success, and because of some other issues that were going on, the army officers and a governor near Delhi also then launched a rebellion. The empire was basically disintegrating around Muhammad Tughlaq. This time, though, he wasn't going to fail. He was a very skillful soldier, and he would march out to secure the town. Ibn Battuta ended up witnessing all of this, and future historians were specifically going to talk about his accounts when describing it, as the traitorous leaders were captured and then thrown to the elephants, exactly as I explained. The quote that he has describing this says, "They started cutting them in pieces, with the blades placed on their tusks, and throwing some of them in the air and catching them. All the time, the bugles and fifes and drums were being sounded." So literally, as these elephants are stomping on these guys and ripping them apart with tusk swords, they're just playing drums and shit.
It's a show.
It is literally a show.
It sounds
it's a
like
death
something
show.
You would see in Game of Thrones, though.
Yeah.
Not something that would be real.
Hey, like, history is wilder than fantasy.
Hate to say it, but do we know if that's true or exaggerated?
There are many different accounts that describe him doing very cruel things. So, yes, this is more than likely true, and he is just one of the best accounts that we have specifically describing it. But many people would talk about specifically what it is that this guy did. And the problem is that there would be many more people that would write about it, because this is one of the key points in which Tughlaq starts to lash out at everyone, against real enemies, but also people that he is imagining are enemies. Even Ibn Battuta came under suspicion at this point. While he was living in Delhi, he ended up getting married to a woman and had a daughter with her. And this daughter was the daughter of a court official who had plotted a rebellion and was executed by the Sultan. The serious problem that Ibn Battuta was facing here was that he was a friend with a Sufi holy man. And in addition to that marriage relation, the holy man refused to do anything with politics and was trying to live a religious life. And so when the Sultan wanted this guy to do something for him, he snubbed him. He refused to do the bidding of the Sultan. He would not do it because he was a pious Muslim man who was going to follow specifically his faith. He wasn't going to follow a secular ruler. The Sultan didn't like this. In retaliation, Muhammad had the holy man's beard plucked out, hair by hair, and then banished him from Delhi. Later, the Sultan would order him to return to court, which the holy man refused to do. The man was then arrested for doing this, tortured, and then beheaded. The following day, the Sultan then went and demanded a list of friends of the holy man, and Ibn Battuta's name was included in this. So for 9 days, he was under house arrest. All this time imagining in horror that he was going to be executed too. As he would say, quote, "I recited lines of prayer 33,000 times and fasted 5 days on end, reciting the Quran from cover to cover each day and tasting nothing but water. After 5 days, I broke my fast and then continued to fast for another 4 days on end, the entire time hoping that he would survive." He got rid of all of his possessions. He put on the clothes of a beggar. And in giving away everything, he was given permission to join a hermit who lived in a cave outside of Delhi, and he just lived like that for apparently 5 months, giving up everything, all of his riches. After all this, he was called back to the palace. And fearfully, he returned. And the Sultan had a change of heart. He was greeted warmly, but also determined at this time to not make any further troubles for himself. He got up enough courage to ask the Sultan, who was now, you know, actually in a good mood, if he would be able to make another Hajj, you know, if he could go on a pilgrimage and leave. The Sultan didn't want this, though. Instead, he had another task in mind, one that Ibn Battuta may actually be perfect for, something he found fascinating. Knowing that he loved travel and sightseeing, the Sultan wanted to make Ibn Battuta the official ambassador to the Mongol court of China. If he agreed, he would accompany 15 Chinese messengers back to the homeland and carry shiploads of gifts to the emperor. Now, he was being given an opportunity to get away from Tughlaq and to visit further lands under the sway of Islam in grand style. This was an offer that was stupidly exciting. And if he refused, just stupid. It was way too dangerous to give this up. So he would go. But I think at this point, though, we're reaching the end of everything that we could talk about here now. Otherwise, the story is going to go on forever. We will, my friends, I promise you, finish the story here going into the third episode. Yes, I know I made that promise here with the first episode that it would be ending at the second. I know, I understand that. But I promise that one is like half written and it is actually going to finish in a decent amount of time. So I promise you it's going to be over.